Welcome to the Reboot Republic Live Budget 2021 podcast. We're delighted to be joined by a massive audience and fantastic guests, experts, policy wonks, advocates, people working on the front line. We're absolutely delighted to have Louise Bayliss from Spark, Anthony Flynn, the CEO of the Inner City Help and Homeless, Michael Taft from SIP2, Ono Brin, Kino Callahan, Fiona Coyle from Mental Health Reform, Tom MacDonald from NERI, Marie Sherlock, a Labour senator, and more. We're going to be discussing tonight, we want to try and touch the key themes of housing, homelessness, childcare, the lack of health, mental health, welfare, inequality, poverty, and more. And question, was this a budget of real change? Was this a budget that can address the historic deficits in our services? And I suppose to put it quickly, in terms of a frame, my analysis is that this is a lost opportunity, that despite the increase in investment, what really was needed was something very, very significantly more. And I think a number of different organizations put it quite well. For example, Tricia Keelty from St. Vincent de Paul said that while it was some of the welfare increases were very, obviously the welfare increases that took place were very welcome, there was no increase in the core social welfare rate. So it means that's still below the poverty line, well below the basic standard of living. And unfortunately, as she said, we're likely to see next year an increase in poverty, an increase in calls to St. Vincent de Paul. There seems to be a major failure to address generation rent. There's no reinstatement of the eviction ban. And as the National Women's Council put it, there was no additional investment into a public model of childcare. Questions of pay equality are still there. And I think it's important to put in context the decades of austerity, the decade of austerity that saw cuts to housing, health, disability, mental health, on top of decades of underinvestment, means that while there was an increase in spending, it doesn't address those austerity cuts, nor does it address the whole issue of the increase in population, increasing need. And as Michael Taft put it, did we actually see, are we seeing austerity under the radar? So I'm your host, Rory Hearn. I'm delighted to have everyone with us on Reboot Live, our analysis of Budget 2021. Tony Groves, I'll hand it over to you.
I think we might as well just wrap it up, Rory. Did you just do the full summation of the budget there? Or you know,
I kept that very short, Tony.
I went downstairs and had a sleep. Listen, folks, we appreciate everybody who's live with us and who's going to be listening in as this comes out. Thanks so much for showing up. It's been hectic, the amount of coverage we've done in the build-up to the budget. But we do need support. Patreon.com/tortoiseshack. This project is quite bigger than when it started out, as many will testify. Please put your hands in your pocket. Show us a bit of love. I am, Rory, I'm going to have to leave you to it because there's a lot here I need to manage. So I'll let you kick off and we won't delay these good people any longer.
Great. Thanks a million, Tony. So we're going to start tonight by, we have a number of politicians with us who are going to give a quick summation of their analysis of it because they have to get back to votes as well. I know we actually have Ono Brin, Sinn Féin TD and spokesperson on housing, Kino Callahan, who is this TD for the Social Democrats and also I think spokesperson or is definitely a member of the Housing Committee, and we have Marie Sherlock, a Labour senator. Owen, maybe I'll go to you first. In terms of your analysis of the housing budget so far, that was put in place, what do you think? Was this, you know, there is an increase in 500 million in investment in housing. As they've said, is it the largest investment ever in housing? What's your assessment of it?
Well, Rory, thanks very much for having us and greetings from the convention centre, where unfortunately myself and Cian will be here until about midnight tonight on the vote. So look, what we've got is, on the face of it, it looks like a very impressive package. There's almost 5 billion plus in housing and 2.7 of that is on the capital side. So when the government says it's the largest housing budget in the history of the state, they're not wrong. The problem is, because of the way in which they're spending the money, it's not going to deliver the kind of transformational change that we need. So, for example, there's only going to be an additional 593 real social homes above what was already committed to by Owen Murphy in Rebuilding Ireland. So we'll hit the 10,000 mark next year if all of those homes are built and bought. But that's nowhere close to what we need, given that on an annual basis, about 14,000 families are coming onto the housing waiting lists. Likewise, on affordable housing, so the minister spent all of July telling us we were going to have a detailed affordable housing plan in September. It was going to have targets. It was going to have regulations. That never transpired. And the only additional spend for affordable housing announced today is 110 million. Some of that is for affordable cost rental, about 400 units, but no detail. And the rest is to be on a government-funded shared equity loan for private sector purchases, which, of course, is a terrible demand-side proposition, which will just lock in on affordably high prices. There's an extra 22 million for homeless services, but primarily on the emergency end, not on prevention end. So really, I suppose, if your question is, are we going to get the kind public house building program for social and affordable need that, say, raised the roof called for during the week, 20,000 public homes on public land, the answer is no. And crucially, the budget is absolutely silent on renters. Nothing about a ban on rent increases for those living in the private rental sector. Nothing in terms of HAP rates. And as you said, nothing in terms of the ban on rent increases and notices to quit. So while the government will be jumping up and down, quoting the headline figure, the real issue is how many extra social and affordable homes will be delivered next year on what would have been committed to if Owen Murphy was still minister. The answer is only an extra 593. And on the affordability end, whether it's public or private affordability, there's no clarity. And I think it's bad news all around.
And just specifically on the question of cost rental housing, because that is something that the government has committed to. And everybody recognises now there's broad consensus that we need a significant supply of this cost rental, which is affordable, secure, lifetime tenancies for renters. And yes, there is no, like, the numbers we're talking about, maybe hundreds coming on stream over the next 2 or 3 years, if even. So what's your assessment? What is there a stream of cost rental investment there?
What happened is in the end of 2018 for budget 2019, government announced 300 million euros over 3 years. So that was for 2019, 20 and 21 to deliver about 6,500 affordable homes. A portion of those were to be cost rental and a portion were those to be affordable purchase. The problem is only 50 of those units are currently under construction. There are 50 cost rental units in Dunleer Rathdown. And the proposed rent is 1,200 euros a month. There are other plans that haven't reached the planning stage or are in planning. But again, you're looking at rents of 1,200 or 1,300 euros a month plus. And there seems to be no clear commitment from government to do what they've done with social housing, which is set out year on year annual targets for the delivery of genuinely affordable homes to rent through the cost purchase or cost rental model or to purchase through a purchase leasehold model. And if you looked at Aisling Kenny's piece in RTE this morning, she was commenting on what appears to be a row between the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform and the Minister for Housing over whether there would be a kind of a state-backed initiative here. Unfortunately, Dara O'Brien, true to Fianna Fáil form, is moving towards a government-funded private equity loan, basically a secondary loan you'd have to take on top of you maxing out your central bank loan to purchase a home. And I see nothing, for example, to see approved housing bodies get into cost rental. The proposal of many people to amend the capital advance loan facility for AHBs to be able to deliver social and affordable rental in the one development isn't there. So there's no funding, there's no affordable scheme. And that means local authorities are left trying to kind of scramble around with the complex rules that are there and limited funding, which I think means if we got a couple of hundred affordable rental units next year, I'd be surprised. And on affordable purchase, what you're really looking at is homes that will cost you anything up to 300,000 plus an additional equity share by the state of another 50,000. So again, nowhere near the 200 to 230,000 we need in Dublin. So I would be very concerned that there's a lack of commitment by government, but also by key departments like the Department of Finance and Public Expenditure and Reform to deliver this.
Thanks, Owen O'Brien. We might come back to you before you go, just in terms of your broader analysis of the budget. Keane O'Callaghan, did the government lack ambition in its housing and particularly around homelessness in this budget?
Yeah, I think there was a great opportunity this time, especially in the context, you know, of historically low interest rates and really a huge amount that could be borrowed in on the capital side to invest long term. I think there's a huge lack of ambition here on the whole kind of housing section, especially, as you say, in homelessness. So from what we can see in the budget, it's really repeating what's been happening for years. It's put money, more and more money into emergency accommodation, but there isn't, doesn't seem to be any commitment to putting, you know, decent amount of resources into prevention and then also into, you know, housing first tendencies to give people long-term secure accommodation. So it does seem that a kind of larger structural reform or game-changing policies that they could be putting in place now, especially in the context of those sort of resources being available, it seems that they haven't gone for those. And very much as Owen was saying there, you know, there was an expectation that on the affordable housing side that, you know, you would see maybe a scheme of affordable housing direct build that could be done by local authorities on a scale of thousands. And that's completely missing from this. Really, we just see a kind of continuation of subsidies to private developers or private sector operators. And that's kind of happening across the board in housing. So I think that's a very serious concern I'd have about this.
Great. Thanks, Keane. Marie Sherlock, what's your assessment of the housing budget?
Well, look, I very much share the concerns that are articulated by Owen and Keane there. And I think that the really interesting thing for me is that, you know, under Rebuilding Ireland, we were supposed to see, this is the year we were supposed to see, or next year, the shift towards greater, that there was going to be more people housed through, or there was going to be greater housing delivery through house building and house acquisition compared with placements into HAP or rent supplement. And of course, this budget has completely turned that in its head. And we see an additional, 5,800 allocations into HAP and rent supplement next year. And what is it, 583 in terms of house building. So I think, like, I'm really struck, Fianna Fáil have spent a lot of time talking about the need to build houses. And yet we see their first budget in government and the path that Rebuilding Ireland was supposed to be taking, that greater shift into house building has been completely turned. So I think there's been a lot of money thrown at the housing budget, and that's the important thing here. It's not for want of resources, but how it's being allocated is of huge concern, and we're simply repeating the mistakes of the past.
And in terms of the, just, I know, conscious, Owen O'Brien and Keane, that you have to go in terms of voting. Owen, maybe first, what do you think the government should have done? Like, how much investment should have gone in if we were to see a sort of radical change that people recognise is needed?
Well, the overall quantum should have been in the region of in terms of capital spend, should have been 2.8 to 3 billion. But crucially, as both Marie and Keane have said, it's also what you spend it on. So what we see here is, for example, we've more money going into the Help to Buy scheme, which inflates private house prices. We've more money going into HAP. We've more money going into the Social Housing Current Expenditure Programme. And even the 110 million for affordable housing, a chunk of that is going to go into the Shared Equity Loan scheme. So it's not only about the quantum, somewhere between 2.8 and 3 billion, it's how you spend it. And again, like, the cheapest way to deliver really good quality public homes to meet social and affordable need is to build and buy. And when I say buy, many of these are derelicts that you renovate or vacants that you renovate in our city and town centres, large volumes of homes. But for that, every local authority needs a target. And those targets on the social housing side need to be substantially bigger than they are. And we need clear annual targets for our cost rental and affordable purchase. And look, Dara O'Brien's going to be in front of the Housing Committee in a couple of weeks. And when we ask him how many affordable homes to rent and buy will be delivered by government next year and what price will they be, he won't be able to answer it. And the reason is because he doesn't know. So it really is about focusing on the types of building that's required. The only other thing I'll say is this. We know from the ESRI that private sector completions are going to be down next year and possibly early into the year after as investors get cold feet or as mortgage approvals and drawdowns fall. So it is absolutely essential that the state steps in. And so long as it's good value for money, the state acquires those sites and builds out those homes, albeit for social and affordable use, while also keeping all those construction workers in employment. And a really simple thing, and I've said it before, but I'll say it again, allowing local authorities and approved housing bodies to use the capital advance loan facility, that's a capital advance for delivery of social homes, to allow that to be used for mixed social and affordable rental schemes would be a game changer, because it would mean any developer who is stuck and looking to offload a site at a discount price an HB or local authority could go in, snap it up at a good value for money, develop it out, and actually the affordable renters or purchasers in that site would be getting a better deal from the state than if it had been left to the private developer in the first instance. So it's about much more ambition, greater levels of investment. And again, let's not forget the renters, 299,000 private rental tenancies out there, huge numbers of those affected by cuts to PUP in the wage subsidy scheme or just having taken a hit in their wages. Nothing whatsoever to ease their high housing costs, especially in a big urban centre. So, you know, they'll get paid, hit with the extra carbon tax in their fuel bills or their traffic. But they're not going to be able to retrofit those homes. They're going to be stuck with high rents and higher costs of living and no additional support for government.
Thanks a million, Eoghan Brin. Cian O'Callaghan, you brought a motion a few weeks ago in terms of ending child poverty. Do you think this budget addressed child poverty?
No, unfortunately. And not only is it not just child poverty around the whole issue of childcare and the whole issue around poverty, it's been a very weak budget. In fact, the kind of national affordable childcare scheme that you'd like to see in a budget like this, that I think we could have done, given the kind of fiscal context we're in at the moment with historically low borrowing, it's an absolute failure, really. It's just not mentioned in the budget at all. And that's the kind of investment that if we were doing that now, that would have long-term benefits. So if we were bringing in a national childcare scheme now or tackling child poverty, they're the things that would have a kind of long-term benefit for us. So I actually think this is the ideal time for us to be doing this.
Great. Thanks, Cian. Marie Sherlock, in terms of your kind of overall analysis of the budget, do you think it was a budget that moves us towards a republic of equality?
Well, I think, Rory, this budget was designed to dazzle because obviously there was a lot of bits in the budget designed to confuse and impress, many voters out there, many households. But I think the very real question tonight is that I think a lot of workers, a lot of households, those without jobs will be saying to themselves, what does this budget deliver for them? And the reality is, for the most part, very little. And I think my overwhelming sense of the budget is that there's been a number of missed opportunities, like a missed opportunity to reform the employment wage subsidy scheme so that you keep businesses afloat, right, which we need to do, but that you also use the opportunity to ensure that workers who are on short-time hours, that they use the time that they're not working to train and to upskill so that we're not losing the opportunity of the crisis. I think there's an element as well of failing to join the dots. Like, you know, it's really positive that there was an increase of 10,000 places for training and reskilling. But, you know, if somebody's on the PUP payment at the moment, they have to transition to job seekers benefit and then on to the return to education, the VITAS payment or the return to education allowance, back to education allowance, sorry. So they're having, there's no incentive to go away and take up training. And we know in particular, those who have, let's say, lower levels of educational attainment, are some of the most exposed and vulnerable workers in this crisis. No guarantees that they're going to get their jobs back when indeed some of their sectors are going to properly reopen, particularly in some parts of the hospitality sector or indeed retail. And I think there's a real question now about how we actually empower people who don't have jobs at the moment or people who are in jobs but want to try and retrain and make themselves more resilient for the future, how we help them in that. I think the other thing, and I suppose just in terms of the overall macroeconomic picture of the budget, to me there's a certain irony that the single largest revenue generator in this budget was the carbon tax. So there's a lot of talk about looking after the hardest hit and all that in this budget. And of course, we saw the miserly 10 cent increase in the national minimum wage. But, you know, the carbon tax is going to hit lowest income households the hardest. And we're going to be a long time waiting or a while waiting for retrofitting or whatever. So to me, the sequence has to be changed. We need to get the retrofitting first and then the carbon tax increases afterwards.
Great, Marie. Thanks a million. Tony,
sorry,
you want
just,
to come in?
No, just say a couple of things that we've had some great comments about from the audience already about the fact that in the years we've known this was a building up to a crisis, and yet this opportunity hasn't been handled as a crisis. And Lorcan Soar is in the audience, and he's made a great point that housing is seen as a market problem and not a social one. And that ultimately is what it boils down to. We keep looking for market solutions to what should be a social crisis. Sorry, Keane, Rory, go ahead.
Yeah, Keane, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, and I think like everybody agrees that the minimum amount of houses, for example, that we need every year is about 35,000 minimum. And the private sector on its own, at best, is probably able to produce about 15,000 of them. So if you even just look at it from that point of view, the only place that the other 20,000 can come from is from the public side and a mix of affordable, cost rental and social homes. So the government agrees on the 35,000, but yet every kind of policy they put in is all based on just trying to prop up and increase the private sector side of that. And that ultimately, you know, hasn't worked. It's completely failed. Everyone kind of knows it's failed and hasn't worked. And yet their policies are just variations on that. So that is the key problem here. And, you know, what developers have been doing as well is they've been building more at the, you know, the high end, the high price. Even their financing costs are more expensive because it's higher risk. There's speculation in it, so they have to get more of a return, all that. So like, it's quite well established, quite proven that if you can cut a lot of that out, then you can produce much more affordable housing. So it's that fact that we're kind of repeating the failed policies of the past on this and not looking for new models is part of the difficulty. So rather than having a new model of affordable housing, it's they're basically looking at unaffordable housing produced by private developers and seeing, can we tweak this to try and bridge the gap for people looking to buy them? So I think they're really taking the completely the wrong approach in it in terms of how they're looking at it.
That's great. Thanks, Keane. I'm just wondering, I've Anthony Flynn there in terms of inner city helping homeless. Thanks a million for joining us, Anthony. And I know Aidan Regan from UCD is there so as well. So maybe if we go to Anthony and then Aidan. Firstly, Anthony, in terms of homelessness, do you think like the budget put an extra 20 million into homelessness? Do you think that the government, again, that idea of, you know, not wanting to end, not of course it wants to end homelessness, but it hasn't set out the aim to end homelessness. It's like tackle homelessness. Do you think that was evident in their kind of what they set out in terms of the budget on homelessness?
I think there was a clear lack of ambition right across the board in what we saw in regard to funding for homeless services. You know, that there is no aim. There's, you know, although, as Marie had said, you know, we're throwing money at a problem, but yet we don't have a plan, you know, on how we're going to fix that problem. And if we look at the expenditure in terms of, you know, what we're pumping into the private market in terms of hotels and B&Bs and everything else, we seem to be maintaining and sustaining a homeless crisis rather than actually trying to eradicate a homeless crisis. And that's been going on for a number of years, you know, and previous successive governments, you know, have ensured that's maintained. And, you know, again, with the lack of ambition, we look at the money that's being pumped into, you know, everybody over the last number of months has been forced into HAP accommodation, particularly through COVID-19. And the money's, you know, we're talking 2.4 billion, I think, in terms of HAP and RAS accommodations, 15,000 HAP tenancies that have to be created through that. But again, that's pumping more money into the private sector. And Lorcan Soar was 100% right in his comment there. You know, what we're doing is what we're looking for a private market to fix what is a social problem. And, you know, some of the previous speakers have said in terms of, you know, what can we actually look at build in terms of the private sector? The private sector cannot build enough houses every year in order to basically fix the crisis that we have. I think it's over, I might be corrected on this, but it's over 93,000 people that are on social housing wait lists now. You know, those targets are nowhere near going to be met. Some of the local authority targets, as Owen has spoken about, we looked at Dublin. Dublin had 228 direct builds, you know, in terms of social housing on their lands. And yet, you know, the breakdown today, we're looking at thousands of homes is what they're going to be told us, or what they've told us is going to be built on local authority public lands, 2,900. But those are in agreement most of the time with the private sector, like we saw in O'Devonley Gardens and stuff like that. You know, we're over-reliant and over-dependent on the private sector in order to fix that social problem. And I think, again, the lack of ambition here within this budget today. You know, us that are on the ground, we haven't seen any changes in terms of homelessness. The problem continues to get worse, and you know, we're forecasting a bad winter coming into December, and I think that there's nothing here in this budget that actually excites me at all.
Thanks, Anthony Flynn. We'll come back to you later on. Hope you can stay with us. Aidan Regan, Associate Professor in Political Economy in UCD. In terms of the overall framework of the budget, the government obviously is, as we said, you know, stating this is the biggest spending budget in the history of the state. But given the size of our economy now, our ability to borrow, do you think that an opportunity was missed to actually really try and transform, you know, particularly investment in areas like housing, healthcare, childcare?
I mean, yes, but it doesn't surprise me hugely either. I mean, in order to have that type of vision and ambition that people are talking about here, you would have to have it underpinned by some sort of, you know, social democratic philosophy about the changed role of the state in the economy. And the present government doesn't share that philosophy or doesn't share those ideas. So when I think, in a sense, the way the present government, particularly Fine Gael, are approaching this budget is that it's an emergency response to a crisis, that they will mobilize the resources to provide the economic support that's necessary, but they don't really have a vision for the role of the state in the economy and taking advantage of the kind of radically new kind of monetary fiscal policy world that we're entering into. I think for them, that's more of a risk than anything else. And it's probably no surprise that, you know, the budget was caveated with this kind of narrative of we want to get back to balanced budgets and reducing the deficit as soon as possible. So it doesn't surprise me that this ambition and that vision is not there, because to have that, you'd have to really believe in the role of the state in providing public infrastructure and public housing. And you would have to really believe in joining up the dots, using the negative real interest rate environment to put together some sort of fund that would directly build, as people are saying here, it's about building houses fundamentally. And there's lots of kind of repackaged announcements in the budget. So again, it just doesn't surprise me. In order to generate the outcomes that people are talking about here requires a changed politics.
Great, Aidan. Thanks a million. I hope you can stick with us. Well, I wanted to go...
Aidan has to run shortly, but Aidan, okay. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us. And I will say, go back and listen to some of Aidan's other conversations on his own podcast, guys. He's done some good ones with... And the one he's referring to there is with Eric Lonergan around the change and how we need to look at how we move on. We won't necessarily agree with all of it, but it's always good to have that conversation. Thanks, Aidan.
Absolutely. Thank you, Aidan. I want to go to Louise Bayliss next. Louise is representative of Spark, which is Single Parents for the Rights of Children. And Louise has done an analysis and put it out. Just I was reading through your press release. There, Louise.
Somebody did.
Pardon?
At least somebody did.
I'd say a lot more than me now, read it, Louise. Just in terms of the whole area, again, as I asked Keane O'Callaghan as well, in terms of child poverty and the wider issues of childcare in particular, what's your assessment of the budget?
I actually was dumbfounded to think there was no additional money put into the infrastructure around childcare. We know childcare is creaking at the moment. If the pandemic showed anything, it showed the importance of childcare, not just from an economic point of view, which it is hugely economic, but also from a child welfare point of view. The fact that we couldn't see children, we hadn't eyes on children, you know, through schools and creches, there was huge child welfare concerns. But also the child poverty aspect. If a parent can't work, they can't provide for their children. They're caught in a social welfare trap. We know childcare workers are mainly women. We know they're struggling. So, you know, this is a combination of funding for the childcare workers, but also affordable universal childcare for people. The National Childcare Scheme, I have been a vocal critic of it from the moment it was announced 4 or 5 years ago. It has always been on this subsidy basis where it gave a universal tiny bit of money to everybody and took the targeted resources from the poorest. The very first time I went to a presentation with Catherine Zubon, who was the Minister for Children at the time, she did her presentation and she said 90% of people will be better off on the National Childcare Scheme. Now, the first thing I said was, well, who are the 10% who are going to be losing out? So, you know, with a bit of investigation, it wasn't even that hard. It was obviously the ones who were most in receipt of targeted supports at the time. So, i.e. the poorest 10% of children were going to lose out to give what equated to a cup of coffee for the wealthiest families. It made absolutely no sense. And we now have children who have started back in school in September, who are denied places in their creches, in their after-school places, based on the activity level of their parents. I mean, surely the right to the child having access to those places are on the child's needs, not on what the parent is doing. Some parents aren't in a position, whether it's through addiction or through mental health, to be in a job. That doesn't mean we don't want those children going to creches and getting the supports. We should be seeing it as a preventative measure before they get into the stage of being taken into care or social services. This is a preemptive measure. And it's just so depressing that there was nothing done. If ever there was a time to put investment into childcare, now is the time. We failed miserably. So what I got from the budget, and this is where I'm really upset about, is this was a budget that was designed to make sure further people didn't fall into poverty, but it did nothing for the 700,000 already in poverty. And that's shocking to me.
Yeah, no, I think that's quite a striking point that you make in terms of those who are in poverty already. And Tricia Keelty from St. Vincent de Paul made that point as well. I just want to go now to thank you, Louise, to Fiona Coyle from Mental Health Reform. And there was a lot of people pushing for an increase in investment in mental health services. We seem to have seen that, Fiona.
Yeah, I think, you know, broadly speaking, like the numbers are, you know, we got 50 million of increased investment and 12 million of that is to go towards existing levels of service. There's 15 million to deal with COVID and then 23 million to implement the new sharing the vision, the new mental health policy. So, you know, broadly, it's a positive step in the right direction. I think, you know, as I always kind of say on budget day, you can deliver on paper, but it's all about delivering the services and looking back this time next year. Mm. And, you know, for mental health, what we've seen over the years where new money has been given on budget day, it's gotten siphoned back into supporting gaps in existing levels of service. So, you know, the devil is in the details of all of this. The Department of Health briefing is taking place tomorrow, I think around 12 o'clock. So we should have more information at that point, like where exactly this money is going to go and what is being prioritised. But broadly speaking, you know, I think, you know, the sector is welcoming the increase that was announced today. But yeah, let's see if it is all new money. And if that 12 million is an accurate figure that on what's needed by the Department of Health in terms of that existing levels of service next year, it seems we were asking for 30 million. And that's what we had been told that would be needed. So it does look relatively low figure. But overall, you know, we do welcome what was in budget 2021 today. And yeah, I suppose that the prioritisation, I was listening to the first half of the speech and heard Minister Donoghue, before he went into his poetry segment, refer to the mental health needs of the nation. And for 1 minute, I was kind of going, oh no, here we go again, you know, talking about mental health, but where's the money? But fortunately, some promises did come in the second half of the budget. So yeah, broadly welcome it, but need to see the details tomorrow.
And do you know that call was made for the proportion of mental health as a total of the health budget to be increased significantly, I think, to in the region of 10%. Do you know, did that take place?
No, that hasn't taken place. And in actual fact, we will see. So we're sitting at 6% currently. and because the overall health budget has increased quite significantly, we're actually going, we don't know the full figures yet, but we estimate it could be as low as 4% our mental health investment would be. And yeah, that's something I suppose we need to look at in terms of, you know, that parity of esteem between physical and mental health. And, you know, while there is an investment today, going forward, we really need to recognise that mental health impact of this pandemic is, you know, just as important and just as important to address as the physical impact, because it will stay with us for years to come. Long after the virus has left this island, you know, people are going to be feeling the mental health effects of what we've gone through and what we continue to go through. So yeah, we'll be digging into that a little bit more. And we you know, we heard today points being made that it's not a normal health budget. We can't look at those same percentage figures because you've got PPE and all this other stuff in there. But I think at the end of the day, the recommendation is the recommendation. It's in Sláinte Care at 10%. We need to be working towards that in every budget.
And Tony, you want to come in?
No,
there?
Just actually, there's a lot of people in the comments sharing your concerns, Fiona, around the lack of specificity around the allocation for those funds. There are actually some qualified medics and people in the audience who are making the point around, you know, a lot of this around that has been double counted already in the winter plan. It was already in the Sláinte Care plan. It was already in the, and I think it was actually, I'm right in saying it was Michael Taft made the point earlier that there's a whole exercise to be done in unpacking things that were already announced from these new announcements today and how, what's actually new, you know. So like, I just think people, we have to be raised, we don't want to seem overly skeptical and to be doing it down, but if it hadn't been the largest budget in the history of the state, you'd be worried in the middle of a global pandemic and you can borrow for zero. Surely we should, that should have just been a given. But I think, you know, just to echo what you've said, Fiona, a lot of people share those concerns.
And thanks, Tony. And just to finally, Fiona, like, clearly there, this increase is very welcome. And but the question is, will it actually be able to be sufficient to respond to that increase, massive increase in level of need around mental health as a result of the pandemic, as a result of rising poverty and inequality?
Yeah, I think that's a question that's ever evolving, listening to some of the contributors. And we spoke on our podcast last week, Rory, about, you know, how inequality feeds into mental health, and, you know, mental health, those experiencing mental health difficulties are also, I suppose, more risk to be living in poverty, and kind of have that intersectionality that exists. I think it's probably not enough going into next year. I think it's something that the government will need to come back to. The winter plan contained no money for mental health, so that's one plan we can rely on. The COVID resilience plan had indicators in there around increased staffs, increased beds, but we don't know where the money from that is coming from. Is that the money that's coming from this new money that was pledged today? So there's so many different plans happening. What also has been announced just over the weekend is that we have a new policy in place. That's great, long time coming. On Saturday, the minister announced the establishment of a national implementation and monitoring committee. So a kind of oversight group for that new policy. And that group's role is going to be really important, especially during COVID and afterwards, to look at, OK, what are the areas that we need to move forward on? Because mental health, before COVID ever happened, it was underfunded. People were waiting, you know, up years, some people, including children, to access services. And we see in the evidence that's coming out slowly that the need is growing. So, yes, this is welcome, this money. But, you know, it's an evolving situation. And, you know, we will be kind of keeping an eye on things. And we would hope that the government will continue to monitor and invest as needed into next year, because we're still in the middle of a global health pandemic, which includes mental health.
Great. Thank you so much, Fiona. Fiona Coyle from Mental Health Reform. I'm going to go next to Michael Taft. Michael Taft, economist with SIFTU, and him of the Notes from the Front fame, and one of our the most regular guests.
The guy with the record number of attendances, and Anthony Flynn is on here, so that's saying something. He's probably been on half a dozen times as well.
Yes, unfortunately, we make no money here. Plug, plug, patrons, please. Well, obviously, you're all patrons, but for when this goes out wider, please sign up and support us so we can give poor Michael a few bob when he comes on the show on his regular contributions, and maybe he could buy a stronger light bulb for his room then. Michael, listen, what was your assessment of the budget in terms of a kind of a broad economic approach? Did it seize the opportunity that, you know, a lot of people have made the case that was here, that is here? You need to turn on your microphone, Michael. We'd love to leave you off, but you need to turn it on.
No, it didn't seize the opportunity. I mean, in addition to many of the excellent points been made by all the speakers so far, two things strike me. First off, when you look at public investment, which is capital expenditure, public investment, it is only increased by 600 million euros over what they were going to be spending anyway. To put that in context, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, which I think most people know is not a spendthrift organization at all, they recommended a stimulus package of 10 to 12 billion euros driven by public investment. It was a pathetic increase in public investment. And the reason why that's so important is because public investment creates social assets, social goods, which I think that, you know, Owen and Kian especially highlighted in terms of housing. One example of that, as Lorcan said. So that's the first thing that struck me. The government is not veering towards the creation of public assets, which can serve the economic and social good. And therefore, we teeter back into market responses. Secondly, taking a real step back, it is so interesting that there was no attempt to link things like stakeholder engagement, social dialogue, some form of collective or democratic participation and oversight by civil society, trade unions, community groups, to link those with business supports. In fact, you know, usually everybody talks about social dialogue because it's such an amorphous term, it doesn't offend anybody. We didn't even get one mention of that. So I think that's showing an indication that this is an employer-focused budget and that the kind of recovery that we will get is a top-down technical recovery, which is trying to bring us back to normal, to an old normal, which I think we would all reject. Now, I mean, if I just quickly move on to three things, because it's better to light a candle than curse the darkness. We should understand the budget as this is just one of a series of potential fiscal interventions. Already the government has said they'll be making more decisions next year. We've already had a July intervention. We could have another intervention sometime in the spring. So this is not the end all and be all for, you know, but until budget 22. There's three things to look at. First off, there's the National Economic Plan, which is going to be developing plans on a sectoral level. That means how we do business, how we do business, how workers, their wages and working conditions are involved in those enterprises, things like the carbon imprint, carbon footprint of those businesses, everything from gender equality to wage equality to again, this thing of stakeholder engagement. So look at the sectors that have really been hit and see, you know, the ability to intervene in that debate and talk about a restructuring of those industries for the economic and social good. Meat processing, hospitality, retail, transport, never mind the big caring industries like childcare, nursing homes, and home care services. So we really have to intervene on the national economic plan and not leave it to business interests and to technical interests. Secondly, there's a 3.4 billion euro recovery fund that is unallocated. Now, I know that we all have different, you know, we all have different agendas and they're all good agendas, but it would be great if there could be a consensus among progressive political parties and civil society groups, even just in a broad way, of how that 3.4 billion euro should be spent. you know, because we've talked about all the missed opportunities here in this program. So here is an opportunity for us to begin to work together to do that. And thirdly, it is very clear that we need an imaginative, creative reform of our social protection or welfare system, because there's two groups that are getting really hit hard by our anemic social protection system. And that is those obviously out of work and are reliant upon social protection, but even those who are in work and have one of the worst levels of in-work benefits in Europe. What we need to do is have a welfare social protection reform that actually unites the interests of groups both inside work and outside work. Really, Rory, this is about, ultimately, this is about moving from opposition moving to a government in waiting, not only among the political parties, but of all civil society groups. That's what we should be aiming for.
Michael Taft, it's great, as always, to have you on. I'm going to go next, and again to say that it's absolutely amazing to have such a fantastic panel and people lining up. And I think actually we could go on probably for a couple of hours doing this podcast. But the problem is, once you start going beyond a certain amount of time, people stop listening. But we could still listen to ourselves. But no, it is really, and I thank all our panelists and guests for staying on with us. And I'm delighted now to go to Lorna Fitzpatrick, who is the president of the Union of Students of Ireland, my old organization when I was there many years ago. And as a young person, Lorna, did and student, did this budget give you hope for the future of this country?
Unfortunately, no. I think, especially from a student perspective, I think it really didn't try and address any of the systemic changes or challenges that are there for the higher education system or for students themselves. We called for additional core funding as outlined in Cassell's back in 2016.
Lorna is gone.
And looked for a reduction in student contribution. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Keep going. You just went for
dodgy internet. The joys of rural Ireland. the reduction in the student contribution charge would have been one way of trying to address the longer term systemic barriers that students and young people face in terms of trying to access education. Instead, we got a once off €250 payment, which is welcomed, but will buy a laptop or will cover that dodgy internet for a couple of months to be able to access your online teaching and learning. So I think it was a real missed opportunity in terms of trying to, and I know that's a bit of a theme that people have, but I do think it was a bit of a missed opportunity to try and address some of those systemic challenges. But there was some hope, especially for postgrad students in terms of financial supports, which was great. But as I say, I think the longer term issues are still very much there. And like when we talk about the health system and the people who are really helping us through this pandemic, we still have student nurses and midwives who are on the front lines on placement who are not being paid for the work that they're doing or being financially supported in any way for the work that they're doing. And they still have their bills. We still have the accommodation issues. We still have the highest fees in the EU. So there's a number of challenges there. And as I say, I think it was a missed opportunity.
Great. Thanks, Lorna Fitzpatrick, so much for coming on. I'm going to go next to Tom McDonnell from the Nevin Economic Research Institute. Tom, we've set out here and you've patiently listened. Thank you very much to the all the different contributors who've set out, if you think about it, you know, probably, you know, demands and clear needs and ideas that would cost billions additionally to actually invest in. And the question would be, would it actually make economic sense to borrow additional billions that would achieve all these things that have been set out here today?
Well, yes, at the moment it would. I mean, we have a perfect storm for justifying very, very large amounts of borrowing. We have close to zero interest rates, which are likely to remain close to zero for the foreseeable future, and certainly for at least a year beyond the pandemic. We also have a very high unemployment rate, that creates a kind of a mix that justifies high levels of public spending, particularly in relation to investment. We saw the IMF yesterday came out with a report showing that a 1% of GDP increase in public investment would increase private investment 10%, would increase GDP by 2.7%, and would increase employment by 1.2%. So it was very disappointing to see capital spending go up by so little. So it's a real lost opportunity. And I think Michael and Aidan and others have alluded to it, but really the government is trying to get back to the never never land of 2019, where business can just go back to normal. There can be no going back on this. The economy has fundamentally changed. We have to build a different economic model anyway. I would support one based upon universal basic services. We need a dramatic extension in terms of how we spend on childcare. We're just at the very bottom of the barrel compared to other European OECD countries. It's a major barrier to second earners being in the labor force, lone parents. It increases labor costs. Also, on investment, we have lost an opportunity for a year potentially. Public R&D, we're still very, very weak. Higher education spending, again, I bang on about that every year, but again, we're billions off what other countries should be. So yes, in the short term, we can borrow. In the long term, and by the long term, I'm talking about the second half of the 2020s and beyond, we will need to address the elephant in the room, which is the very low revenue capacity of the Irish state relative to other European countries in particular. And that means addressing those revenue gaps. And there's really two areas you can do that. That's one is capital stocks. But the most important one by far is social insurance. And I actually believe that there is a window of opportunity there. The Overton window is open for once to actually make gains in terms of employer PRSI and indeed other areas. This is the social wage, social insurance that Michael Taft talks about. It's a real missed opportunity and it's a real shame because this was the opportunity. Now, to be fair, the National Economic Plan is next month and there may be announcements of significant increases in capital spending from 2022 onwards. In addition, the contingent recovery fund of 3.4 billion, it was implied that some of that might be for public investment. It hasn't been allocated yet, which is strange because if you're holding about 3.4 billion in contingent spending based upon what happens with Brexit and what happens with COVID-19, you would expect that money would be going to things like wage subsidy schemes, pandemic unemployment payments, and subsidies for business. It isn't a natural place to put potentially additional spending on public capital investment, which can often have a lag. And is therefore not ideal as a response to an immediate response to a crisis, but which is important about say, 12, 18 months down the line as you move from the support phase to the stimulus phase. We're still, I mean, it was clear today from the budget documentation, but also from the ESRI and Central Bank that we're still in the support phase. The expectation is that unemployment will be still over 10% by next summer. So really, it's hard to overstate what a missed opportunity this is. Even if it was to simply say at this point, we're going to have a massive 10 billion investment stimulus over the next 3 years, but it would only be 1.5 billion in year one, so be it. But just to increase it by 600 million, I think is just amazing.
That's great, Tom. Oh, no, Bryn, I know, conscious you have to go. Just to ask you one last question before you go. Do you think that the government, in a sense, has won the media kind of what you might call it portrayal of this budget, and that those of us who are arguing for that this was a lost opportunity, a missed opportunity, are really, you know, been seen as kind of negative, you know, critics rather than being realistic?
So first of all, apologies for the bells in the background. That's the vote we're just called for. So I'll head off to that. No, look, I think the nature of this is it's going to take us all a couple of days to unpick the budget in total. A lot of the media are trying to sort out the new expenditure from the pre-existing and pre-announced. And I think over the coming days, it'll become clearer. But also, look, ordinary people don't need folks like us or the media to tell them if the budget is good or bad for them. If the rent is still too high or they can't get an affordable home or they're waiting for a social home or they're on a cut wage subsidy or PUP payment, they'll know it's not working. And I think that's why Michael's challenge to us all is the key one. How do we use the time ahead to build a maximum consensus both inside and outside the Dáil of progressives, of left-wing people who believe in change, to give it to as many people as possible that when the next election comes, real change is deliverable. So we have a lot of work to do, both inside this august chamber of the convention centre and out. But we shouldn't be pessimistic. We need to be optimistic, work hard, convince people that there are real alternatives to do these things better, and make sure next time round there's more of us elected to Leinster House and the Shannon to deliver the change people desperately need.
That bell is just going through our head. At least they're getting good value for the sound system. Owen, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. A couple of comments from people. So, and it's a general theme. There's a theme coming through that people are worried that if we're seeing this in the midst of a pandemic, where's the ambition? So it's kind of, you know, how much of the allocation should be going to this? And everybody's talking about this missed opportunity. Why other people are sort of saying, well, if we're doing this when the chips are down and borrowing is high, when can we address it? And I'm conscious that Anthony Flynn, I know I'm biased because as I talk with the guys in ICHH all the time, but if you're on the front line dealing with homeless services and you see something that you think, you know, is it an additional 22 million to homeless services next year? And additional funding to HAP, and we see all of these things, all of this, as Michael quite rightly pointed out, all of it's connected, whether it's health policy, housing policy, environmental policy, it's all, you know, good health policy is good housing policy. Anthony, do you think we're going to get anywhere in the next 12 months, or are we going to be back here in 12 months time fighting?
Look, I think, yes, we definitely are. I think Owen said something now, unpicking the budget over the next couple of days, you know, and actually delving into what was expenditure that was already there. Like, you know, we look at Rebuilding Ireland. Rebuilding Ireland has been a sink and duck for the last 2-3 years. You know, so even money that has been put into that going into 2021, we're not going to meet those targets. You know, we envisage we're not going to meet those targets, you know. And even some of like tackling some of the inequalities, you know, looking through some of the figures, when we see 3 million additional to source travel accommodation, like, you know, I totally understand that some of the councils are sending back money in regard to travel accommodation, but it just actually outlines the pure inequality right across the system. You know, measly 3 million to tackle travel accommodation is just absolutely ridiculous. But like, you know, I really do. You know, every year we look at this and I say to myself, you know, we might make headway here this year. We might make headway. And, you know, the minister had come out previously, Dara O'Brien, you know, and made so many promises over the last number of months, you know. And I've seen them failures, you know, right on the ground. And in particular today, like, we have 5 new family presentations here in the office today. And I've actually got someone in our family in our boardroom now at the moment. Things don't change year on year with the budget. But the time the budget kicks in, you know, it's going to take a lot of time before we see anything that's on the ground in regard to real, real change. So, again, you know, I'm not optimistic about it whatsoever.
Great. Thanks, Anthony. You know, it is the reality there. You know, your family's, you know, going into homelessness. And it's incredible that the one thing that wouldn't have cost like a cent to implement would have been to reinstate the eviction ban. And it just, like, I think we all have to keep that pressure on and calling for that ban to be reinstated. It's just, you know, it worked to stop homelessness, to reduce it. It needs to be put back in. Louise Bayliss from Spark, what's your assessment? Are we potentially, as people are asking, is this going to be paid for austerity through austerity again in years to come?
Well, that's a real risk, Rory, because somebody's going to pay it back. And we know from the last measure in recession, major recession, it was lone parents and those who were relying most on social welfare who paid the highest price. And there's a real fear that would happen. Now, as we sit today, 45.4% of lone parents are already living in deprivation. There's nothing in this budget that are going to help them. Somebody else I was talking to today in disability sectors, and they've got similar levels of deprivation. There was nothing done for them to accept increasing the income disregard, which is great for those, you know, who are disabled who can work. But the point is, those who are most vulnerable, who are most sick, can't work. And there's nothing for them either. And already 47% of them are living in deprivation. These are real people and they're already suffering. And while it's great to see, and I suppose one of the things that the pandemic unemployment payment of 350 was really welcoming, but it did really show that the government, by doing that, acknowledged that the 203 euro people are expected to live on who are long-term unemployed, it's not sustainable. It is living in poverty. And that still hasn't changed for those people. This is the second year in a row that corp social welfare payments have not increased. And that's going to be very hard in a to get solidarity when somebody's on 203 euro and they're looking at somebody else who lost their job on 300. You know, we need to bring it all up and we need to kind of have a more equal distribution of whatever gains there are. And likewise, in next year and the year after budget, when there are people going to have to pay, make sure that the poorest aren't paying again.
Thanks a million, Louise Bayliss, for joining us. I'm going to get some final comments from our panelists. Michael Taft, you coined this phrase at the last in our last podcast, austerity under the radar. Was this budget austerity under the radar?
No. This wasn't an austerity budget. Now, obviously, it did not meet the demands of many key social constituencies. But you know, the government did pile in a lot of money into 2022, and we'll be running the similar deficit as we're running this year. However, the issue of what's going to happen once we get past the pandemic crisis, which of course is virus dependent, vaccine dependent, but once we get past that, that's where the conflict will occur. That's where, you know, the political battles will start. And what I mean by austerity under the radar, it's not, you may not see a situation like we saw in the last crisis, where the minister stands up on budget day and says, we're actually going to cut social protection payments. We're going to cut public services, you know, an actual euro amount. You may not see that, but what you will see is a squeeze. Public spending on public services and social protection will not keep pace with inflation, will not keep pace with population growth, will not keep pace with our changing demographics. And what I mean by that is, you know, we're going to become an older society over the years ahead. So that money will be squeezed and there'll be less and less money there to fund more and more projects. It won't be a cut, but it won't keep pace. And the only reason why they would do that, and let's be clear, is because they want to keep a low tax economy, specifically low taxes on, as Tom mentioned, capital stocks. I would go as well as capital income, but key to that is a low social insurance environment, especially for employers. So that's what we have to look out for.
Just one point that has been raised a couple of times today is the fact that the top 20%, and I think it was Stephen Kinsler had this out with me a few weeks ago, you know, have a net worth of an average of about 875,000 in not including family home. And the bottom 20% have a net worth of about 1,000 quid. So there is potential there for other taxation before we go to the ones that are going to hit those who are already feeling the pinch. Let's put it has capacity. The system could bear it.
Well, I mean, we have Tom McDonald here with us, and he actually, if not wrote the book, certainly wrote the main article on a wealth or net assets tax. And I understand, according to polling, that a majority of people would support a wealth tax. It would only impact on the top 1 or 2%. And OK, it would maybe raise 300, 400, 500 million euros. It's not going to solve all of our problems. But, you know, you build on that over the years and, you know, 300, 400, 500 million. That could build you a lot of social and affordable homes.
Yeah, Tom, you want to come in there. Would you have introduced a wealth tax in this budget?
I would.
Tom. That's great to hear.
and it would have been the least economically damaging tax you could possibly imagine. 98% of households wouldn't even notice. And in fact, if you were to generate 500 million from a wealth tax, that would pay for the type of reforms that SIPTU have called for in terms of childcare, where they've identified that about 500 million would deal with the cost issue in childcare and would deal with the crisis in wages issue in childcare. So we can say half a billion euros is only is not a pot of gold, but you can solve real problems with that. And again, inheritance tax is another area where you could wring out a lot of extra euros without really impacting upon anybody's quality of life. So there's a lot of areas that just won't be touched. But Michael's right. The real battles here are going to be about 2022 and 2023 and what kind of revenue base and what kind of level of public spending we're going to end up with. So really, this is just a firefighting budget to allow them to go back to where they were. But it's not about a fundamental reform or change in the type of economy that we have. And it doesn't achieve that whatsoever.
Tom McDonald from NERI, thanks a million for that. I'm going to finish up with Fiona Coyle. Fiona from Mental Health Reform, just last word. Do you think in terms of inequality, mental health, you know, we've a long way to go. How do you see kind of that continuing to impact?
Yeah, we're just at the beginning of a journey in terms of reforming our mental health services. Like, our last policy vision for change was launched and the country went into recession. Our new policy just got launched and, you know, once again, the country is in recession. So it's positive to see that, you know, the funding hasn't been slashed like it was previously. But, you know, even today, looking at the fact that there's a separate COVID budget line to what is the new money going for the development of new services, means that there's, you know, that's something we would expect. 38 million year on year going forward is needed now, and a lot more. And just something maybe that struck me today to finish on, that was kind of in the budget speech about developing, the Department of Finance are working on national wellbeing indicators. And I think that's going to be really interesting because, you know, how are we measuring the well-being of our country? Like, what are those indicators? And is that something, you know, I don't know what the process has been. We haven't been involved in it personally, but it's something I'm really eager to learn more about as well, because we need to have better indicators going forward. And we need to ensure that this isn't, you know, this isn't the kind of the present before the breakup, as they say, that there is going to be, you know, a strategic forward thinking approach to how, especially in relation to mental health service, how we're going to deliver them for the needs that we're seeing are going to increase month after month.
Thanks so much for joining us, Fiona, and thank you to all our panelists. And just before I hand over to Tony to wrap up, I did want to say that, you know, the it has been really, really good to highlight, you know, the different areas that need to be invested in. And we're doing this on the basis of not just to be overly negative or to moan and crib, as Bertie Ahern used to say, the cribbers and moaners. We're actually trying to point these out to achieve real progressive development and achieve what we can actually achieve and to, as a country, and to achieve that republic of equality. And we will continue to point that out and continue to push. And thank you, all of you, for the work that you do on that until we actually achieve that equality and social justice. So thanks all for joining us. Over to you, Tony.
No, I just want to follow up with how amazing is it to be sitting here and to listen to these great people on the night of a budget. I'm really, really, really taken aback by the quality of the contributors and the people in the audience, the questions. Great event, and I want to say well done, Rory. It's been a mad couple of weeks putting all this together. Every single panel, from mental health to inequality to childcare to the economy, all of those things, we really appreciate it. Listen, folks, please do give us a hand. Look, it's that I hate to do it, I hate asking, but patreon.com/tortoiseshack helps keep this show running. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye bye.